You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. And yes, Jav, your microphone is hot. We are...
Mine's cold.
Joined once again by none other than the fabulous duo of Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Not to say that you're the only co-editors there. There is another co-editor.
Yes, there is.
Yes,
Troy.
There is. And he is in the country.
He is
yes.
in this country.
Yes. Persuading him to come on the radio might be a rather hard
might
thing,
might be very
though.
Difficult.
Uh-huh. All right, we're going
unless we take a Friday night where he isn't quite in bed yet at this time.
All right.
Well, we'll think about that one. So it's been a busy week. Busy week both locally and nationally.
Yeah, it has.
Yes, it has.
And city council, for one, has been fairly busy this week, sending off letters.
Yes, voting and sending off letters. I'm going to talk about the voting part. The city council voted on a 7-2 vote for the most expensive package for the replacement of the viaduct. But the two council members that voted against were Nick Licata and Judy Nicastro. And Nick Licata, in particular, had some very good objections to building the most expensive options. And I just want to run through those really, really quickly. His position is, why not do a retrofit or a rebuilding of the viaduct, which would only be about $3.5 billion. The most expensive option is going to be upwards of $11 billion, possibly $12 billion. Now, he says it's possible that the damage to the viaduct occurred over time, not just with the 2000 earthquake, so there's a question as to whether another earthquake would really make it topple. He hasn't received all of the engineering reports that he requested from the state yet on the viaduct and the viaduct damage, so he's not exactly sure about that, but he says it's possible. There's also no information on the probability of a large earthquake within the next 10 years, which is what they consider to be the life of the viaduct. So you have to ask yourself, how probable is it that a large earthquake would actually topple the viaduct and damage the seawall downtown?
Yeah, compared to how probable is it that a recession, say, will damage the social safety net that we might repair with the same money.
And make it impossible for us to actually build a $12 billion replacement. Now, the tunneling, you have to look at the tunneling itself. Right now, there are zero funds available to pay for a replacement for the viaduct. Referendum 51, the state referendum that's going to be on the ballot this November, only provides $500 million for construction of a viaduct replacement. The regional proposal, if it ever makes it to the ballot, will only provide $1.5 to $2 billion, and half a billion of that is going to come from future tolls on the viaduct itself, and that may be too high an estimate for what you can collect in tolls. So there's like a $7 billion shortfall. You have to ask yourself, can we really build a replacement for only $3 billion? I don't think so. And you can't take it like Sound Transit and build it in sections. I mean, it's not going to work. You can't build half of a viaduct replacement or build a viaduct replacement with no ramps.
In this city, they certainly could. You've seen the intersection out by the Arboretum. They started a freeway that way.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That was stopped by neighborhoods
that didn't want it, though.
Yeah, that was not stopped by lack of funds.
That was supposed to be a freeway running all down the west shore of Lake Washington, and can you imagine what this city would look like had they built that?
That's true. So anyway, there's going to be a public presentation on the viaduct option on Tuesday, July 30th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the BF Day Elementary School in Fremont. That's at 921 Linden Avenue North. So that's Tuesday at 5 p.m. And you can go down there, look at the most expensive option and give your comments. Mm-hmm. I think people should be paying attention to this issue because there's been so much attention paid to Sound Transit and so much attention paid to the monorail and whether or not the monorail will come in on budget and how will it pay for itself and what will the operating costs be. And there's been almost no attention at all paid to the viaduct and the viaduct replacement. Now, there's another...
And the money.
And where the money will come from.
And who will wind up with the money once it is spent.
Right. And there's another issue involved here, too. The question of why did the city council and why has the city opted for the most expensive option when there were various options discussed. I think that it's quite clear that they wanted the most expensive option because it's going to tunnel under Queen Anne as well as tunnel under downtown. And this is going to, in the words of people who support it, this is going to benefit Vulcan Inc., Paul Allen's property holding company in South Lake Union, because it will allow him to connect his properties there with Lower Queen Anne, particularly the EMP in the Seattle Center, and that Vulcan Inc. wants to use the current Battery Street Tunnel, wants to turn it into a water tunnel in order to link the waterfront ferry to South Lake Union, because Vulcan Inc. is building a waterfront park on South Lake Union to kind of spruce up the neighborhood and to raise the value of Paul Allen's properties there that he wants to eventually develop. So I think people should be up in arms over the fact that the city of Seattle wants to spend almost $12 billion to benefit a single developer.
Yeah, and there's actually another circuit of benefits here, too. And this actually can also get us into the whole Nicastro thing with the letters and the mm-hmm. trade unions, which is that all of these very high-budget items, the monorail, the Sound Transit, the viaduct replacement, all of that is going to be benefiting the local trade unions. And the trade unions are pushing for the most expensive options on all of these. And that is much of the force that got Greg Nichols into office, and that is pushing around a fair amount of political weight these days. So that and we saw that also with the stadiums, that dynamic was very much in place. So that is not, it's not to be underestimated either.
And I know that the trade unions view Nichols as their candidate. They worked very, very hard to get him into office.
Very much so.
So I'm not surprised at all that you can have Judy Nicastro come out and say, I got these threats that they were going to support Paige Miller against me in the upcoming upcoming election, you know, if I don't go along with the program.
I have to say, and you know, Greg Nichols is no treat. And you know, we talked a little bit about this before we went on the air. I spent the last couple of days in San Francisco, though, and, you know, somebody like Willie Brown, and, you know, Seattle is a large American city. There's only about 12 or 13 cities in the country that are the size of or larger than Seattle. And, you know, somebody like Willie Brown would have Greg Nichols for lunch, and his deputy mayor, Tim Sice, was a toothpick for the hors d'oeuvre afterwards. I mean, but, you know, Nichols, because he came in after Paul Schell, Judy Nicastro's idea of hardball politics is the ASUW, and Peter Steinbrück's idea of hardball politics is Father Victor trying to decide whether to fire the nanny. I mean, you know, we have people on the city council who really believe in the whole ethic of Seattle nice, and that's how politics are played. And, you know, in an ideal world, it is how politics should be played, but that's not the rules that are played for politics in most of this country. And, you know, Judy Nicastro's whining about it is not going to change that reality. So it comes across as, I think, pretty ridiculous to a lot of the people at City Hall and in the City Council, even though there is very much this power dynamic that's going on between the mayor's office and City Council, and that's part of what Judy was referring to also.
Yeah, so she does have some substance to what she's saying, although I think the way that she's gone about it is kind of immature.
Yeah, very much so, and it really also plays into some unfortunate stereotypes of, you know, little girl whining, which are really, really unfortunate for Judy.
Yeah, it is.
But isn't that going to boost the ratings on her internet show?
However, I think she has also, by doing this, avoided explaining why she voted to provide a break for Hedreen, the downtown developer. Proposal
Nichols
vetoed and was, I believe, right in vetoing.
Yeah, Nichols was absolutely correct to veto that. It was a special favor for a major downtown developer. And here you have Judy Nicastro, who, you know, championed in her campaign renter rights and so forth and housing rights and reforming all of this. And what has come out pretty clearly since then is that Judy basically is on the side of Judy, and that she's a very ambitious young politician. And, you know, here she is now trying to override a veto of a special favor to a developer. And Judy, would you please explain that? I think it's a very good question.
Yeah, explain how that benefits renters, particularly low-income renters in the city of Seattle.
All right. Well, enough of that. Let's move on. There's plenty of national stuff to cover. And one of those things being the Congress Corporate Crime Fighters. It's not a show. Not a show this and fall on Fox.
And
but
Crime Fighting W.
Yes, this week Congress passed a bill to save the stock market, which is pretty much what it will do.
Yep, and the headlines will go right along with it. So
right, it's been called the Corporate Fraud Bill or the Corporate Oversight Bill, however you want to call it. But really, what it is it's kind of a sweep up the mess after everything's been broken, sort of thing. It contains some interesting things that sound good on paper, like a new accounting oversight board, doubling penalties for fraud, protections for whistleblowers, etc. But in practice, it's not going to provide a heck of a lot more than already exists, and I'll just explain why.
In some ways, less, actually.
Yeah. For one thing, CEOs are very, very, very hard to prosecute. You can raise the penalties all you want, but in fact, very, very few CEOs actually get prosecuted, and there are reasons for that. The current bill, for instance, will only apply to crimes that are committed after the bill has been passed. So WorldCom executives won't apply, Enron executives won't have these stiffer penalties, the Adelphia guys who were arrested this week, they won't be subject to these penalties. And also, CEOs are very, very hard to indict and convict in the first place. It's because it's very hard to get insiders to testify against their boss, particularly when some of them are also implicated in the same scandal. CEOs are also smart enough to cover their tracks. You know, I mean, they're not like bank robbers who pick up the gun and go out and knock over a bank in an afternoon. These guys are committing fraud and doing this over a long period of time. They definitely destroy
documents.
And they're
planning very carefully.
Yeah, they plan very carefully, and they cover their tracks. They also have money to hire the best lawyers, much, much, much better than government lawyers. So those are the main reasons why they're very hard to indict and much, much harder to convict. In addition, many of them may not have even broken the law. I mean, we're looking at that in the case of Enron, for example. The U.S. accounting system is a rules-based system. If something isn't written into the books in very intricate detail, and an accountant and a CEO at a company decide to do that thing that's not written in the books, it's perfectly legal. So our system is not based on intent.
Yeah, and also beyond that, there are a number of rules and laws that were simply loosened or taken off the books over the
or
past,
made more vague
or the past 5, 10, 15, 20 years as a result of essentially political corruption in the way our political system
and many,
works.
And many of our accounting rules have not been updated. The FASB, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, has tried, for example, to change the rules on stock options, has tried to institute a rule that would say companies must expense their stock options, but they are subject to lobbying from business groups and high-tech companies the same as Congress is, and their efforts in the past have failed because of lobbying from large business groups.
And you also have, Enron being a very good example for this, you have the invention of whole new industries and you know, whole new ways of making
exactly.
money, and old rules really don't apply very clearly to that.
And the FASB, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, has not been up to the task of writing new rules for these new industries because the accounting industry and because business lobbyists really do not want them to. They want to have free rein. So that's another problem with this bill. This bill does not provide any changes as far as that's concerned. The Accounting Oversight Board that's being set up, you would think, would be able to make that kind of change. But it's not. It's going to be under the jurisdiction of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which itself is suspect. It hasn't caught these people while they were committing fraud, hasn't been able to look at the books of all of the corporations that submit financial statements to it because it's underfunded. This new bill will provide some increased funding, but not enough to help the SEC cover cover the financials of an estimated 14,000 companies that turn in financial statements every quarter, not every year, but every 3 months.
Yeah, and a lot of the money actually that is going into the SEC, I believe it's close to $1 million, is actually coming out of other enforcement practices that govern Wall Street. So it's sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul.
There was also no money in the bill specified to set up this new accounting standards board, so that money's probably going to come from the SEC, which is going to take a bite out of the so-called increase for the SEC. So it's a problem. The biggest thing is what was left out of the bill, particularly covering stock options. We've talked about this in the last few weeks, that one of the things that has led to the current scandals is giving CEOs stock options as compensation, tying their performance to the performance of the company's stock, which means that there is every incentive for CEOs to commit fraud in order to keep the stock price high. Now, that was left completely off the table, and it's because business lobbyists swarmed around Congress and made that their issue. You cannot deal with stock options. Stock options should not be touched in this bill. And in fact, they were very, very, very successful. They included high-tech companies, CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, venture capitalists, biotech companies, the NASDAQ market administrators themselves, Cisco Systems, Intel, Dell, AOL, Time Warner, Sun Microsystems, the Business Roundtable. I can go on and on and on. All of these lobbying groups just swarmed Congress and said, you have to keep stock options off the table.
And bear in mind, these are the people that most senators and congressmen and congresswomen believe elected them.
I mean, yes, these and are the they people did who, elect many
yeah,
of them.
These are the people who provided the money and provided the, essentially the political legitimacy that allowed these people to get into office in the first place, and that will allow them to retain their office in the next election. So they're much more concerned about how these people feel about this particular bill that's important to them than the public good or even public anger around this set of issues.
And it flies in the face of what some analysts have been saying. Greenspan came out earlier this week and said that it's inevitable stock options will be expensed. However, he thinks the Financial Accounting Standards Board should do it. Well, Alan, let me tell you, they've been trying. Okay, even Harvey Pitt has admitted that it's inevitable stock options will have to be expensed, although he thinks it should be sometime in the distant future. So it's just amazing how responsive our legislators can be to businesses when they're right on their doorstep saying we're not going to give you the millions we've given you in the past to reelect you.
At the same time, I mean, there's been this fascinating dual dynamic that's been going on in media coverage of this, particularly in the last week, but really for the last several. You have, on the one hand, extensive media coverage that's along the line of, okay, the slide in the market is over now. The slide in the market is over now. Okay, it's going back up now. Okay, it's going back up now. Okay, it's going to keep going back up now. Well, it's for the long haul anyway. Well, in the long run, we're all going to make money anyway. It's okay now. It's okay now. And you have this constant hand-wringing of whether the market will perform and whether it will stop sliding, which, you know, is understandable when you figure that not so much working classes, because they're all maxed out on their credit cards. They don't have any money saved anyway. But for the
credit
last
cards and home equity loans.
Yeah, but for the last several years, we've had our tax laws rewritten to encourage middle and upper class people, upper middle class people, to, rather than save money for retirement, to put money in 401ks. And these people are opening their monthly 401k statements and finding that their life savings and their retirement is declining in some cases by 40, 50, 60, 80%, that they're losing thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. Now, that may be on paper, but it's very real in the money they would otherwise have been saving, they were encouraged to put in the stock market. And, you know, guess what? Institutional investors are always going to have a leg up on mom-and-pop investors. And, you know, very large institutional investors are always going to have a leg up on relatively small 401k fund investments. So, People in middle class, upper middle class, are most likely to be victimized in something like this. And so while you have the patting people on the head on this, mm-hmm. you also have this undertone, and we saw this particularly this week with the Adelphia arrests, which were very high profile, number one, to reinsure investors, but there was also this undertone of glee, this very sort of class-based, okay, we're watching the fat, rich bastards get their comeuppance. You know, for the last 20 years, we've been working harder and harder, making less and less money, and at the same time, we've got these super rich people who are making even more unimaginable wealth, and they're not working at all, and they're finally getting their comeuppance. Well, of course, only a very small, tiny percentage of them are.
Enjoy it while you can.
Yeah, it's like 100 years of plunder for capitalism, and then we get 3 weeks of revenge. But vicarious
revenge.
And it's
temporary. It's
very, very temporary.
I'm not sure at all that they will be prosecuted for anything, and if they are, how long are they going to go to prison? Especially since the new penalties don't apply to crimes that happened before this new bill was passed. And we're still waiting for WorldCom execs to be indicted. They haven't been indicted yet. And even more, we're waiting for someone at Enron, to be charged with something.
Anything.
And it's not clear that they will be.
Yeah, and there will be other large corporations that will have large scandals coming, too. We've said this in past weeks, that this is, I mean, it's just starting in a lot of ways. But a few weeks ago, I had a very interesting opportunity to have dinner with a woman who, she was a Reagan appointee, actually, who was the chair of the SEC in the late 80s, and she was chair at the time that Rudolph Giuliani was the Southern Manhattan District Attorney, who had a series of very high-profile arrests of Wall Street investment bankers and whatnot. This was after the stock crash of 87. And it was the same sort of dynamic, that it was very much for public consumption, and that, you know, these people were never actually charged. You know, they were led away in handcuffs while the cameras were going, and then they were sort of quietly let loose out the back door, and they never really, really faced any penalties for what they were doing. And what she was saying is that the people who were DAs before and after Giuliani were actually much more effective on issues of white-collar crime, but they weren't politically ambitious the way that Giuliani was, and obviously he used it very successfully and continues to. If Cheney ever goes down for Halliburton, Giuliani could be our next vice president.
That's scary.
It is, but it's specifically because he still has this reputation of being tough on corporate crime, and it's a mirage. He wasn't. But there's this whole thing that's done for public consumption to reassure people that there's some accountability in that system, and that accountability does not actually exist. You look at all the people who were actually indicted, and some of them actually went off to country club jails for a couple of years in the 80s, you know, the Milkins and the various people like that, and they're still worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
And they're still leading a public life. They're still advising corporations. They're
very
still
much so.
Writing books. They're still doing talk shows.
Yeah, one of them, I forget which, now gets like $100,000 per motivational speech at corporations, explaining to them, you know, how to do all this stuff, basically. So mm-hmm. it isn't what it seems to be when you're reading the front pages or watching the evening news these days.
Yeah,
I know Michael Milken was, as part of his punishment, was supposed to teach others about morals in financing.
Yeah, and so he went into private education now, too. He's one of the leading people now in selling privatization of education.
So we only have about 5 minutes left, and I understand you wanted to talk a little bit about John Ashcroft. I know he was getting a few questions from our Senator Maria Cantwell this week. She was asking him, is Seattle going to be a target? You know, do you know anything about Seattle being a potential target for terrorists?
There was a very interesting story on the front page of the New York Times on Wednesday. And actually, I was down in San Francisco yesterday on a radio program with the West Coast Bureau Chief of the New York Times, who they billed the program as New York Times Meets Eat the State, which I thought was pretty hilarious. we got along very well, actually. But the story on the front page was talking about Tom DeLay and Operation Tips, and how a number of conservatives are very, very concerned with Ashcroft over his overstating of the terrorist threat, over all of these vague big warnings that have come out over a number of civil liberties
threats
issues.
To civil liberties.
Over his grandstanding, you know, that he's a lifelong politician who has very much politicized the AG's office, even in a way that Janet Reno did not do. And Reno wasn't a very good politician. Her gubernatorial campaign in Florida is floundering. But there is very much on the right a lot of concern about Ashcroft. He was not nominated, or his nomination was not approved by very much. It was the one contested nomination out of a whole passel full of them that should have been contested.
It was approved as a compromise so that Democrats could work together with Republicans in a divided Senate.
Yeah. So the upshot of this is, the time has come to really push for John Ashcroft being fired. The man is a menace on
it's
any number.
It's time for him to be out of there.
He
should not have been in there in the first place.
Yeah, and he's an extraordinary threat to the country at this point. We're sliding into a police state, and there are a number of reasons for that that predated John Ashcroft. But he's a major influence on that right now, and a major influence on George W. Bush.
Yeah, personal politics in Washington, D.C., people all agree that Ashcroft is very, very popular with George W., which is why he's really in there. He was George W.'s favorite in the cabinet, and I'm sure he fills George W.'s ear with all kinds of stuff that I would rather be saying to
him. So, you know, I really think at this point, I'm going to be writing about this on Monday for Working for Change and probably in some other places too, we need to start pushing and progressives in general and grassroots activists. This needs to be made a priority. We need to get John Ashcroft out, and we need to be building alliances with other groups that are thinking along the same lines.
Yeah, we're coming up on the anniversary of when Congress voted for cash payments to people who had been interned as Japanese Americans during World War II. We should be remembering the internees right now who are in jail without charges and without access to lawyers because of John Ashcroft primarily.
Yeah, and we have no idea how many there are, citizens and non-citizens alike. We have absolutely no idea. Padilla is almost certainly not the only one. Mm-hmm. Among citizens, and there are plenty among non-citizens.
It is time for Ashcroft to go. He is a major criminal in my mind, and I'm sure also many other people would agree if they really knew what was going on or were really paying attention. So it's time for us to talk about it a lot more and see if we can't get him out of there.
Yeah.
And right now, Bush is slipping in the polls, so it's a good time to do it. Because of all the corporate scandals, he's kind of lost the blush of post 9/11 that he had. So it's time to really start talking about the makeup of his government and upcoming elections in November as well.
Oh, I suspect those polls have been wrong for a long time, the whole reason they're created. So a couple minutes left, and got some things happening this weekend that we want to make sure we cover. One of them being Vandana Shiva is in town.
Yes, she will be in town tomorrow evening at Kane. I'm actually going to have a chance to interview her, and I guess she'll be on Mind Over Matters tomorrow morning as well.
Yes, at 7:45.
So, but she's tomorrow night, Kane Hall, University of Washington, for 7 o'clock. For folks who don't know who she is, you should.
7:30,
I'm sorry. She is.
But you should get there early.
Yeah. It will be sold out. She is a remarkable, remarkable woman, Indian physicist, who is one of the leading voices in the world in a number of globalization issues, biopiracy, seed technology, farmers, grassroots food production, but it goes far, far beyond that. You can be talking mostly your focus on this trip, I believe, is water issues, which is a tremendously important issue that people need to know more about. So anybody listening to this should be there tomorrow night.
She's also going to be doing it 6 o'clock. She's going to be having a reservation-only reception and benefit for college she helped create, the International College for Sustainable Living, and that's going to be happening at 6 o'clock. And if people would like to get in on that, which we encourage you to support, because it's actually sounds really cool. I mean, you can hear more details on it tomorrow at 7:45, but the number for that is 206-467-0384.
And we will all be there.
Mm-hmm.
We will.
Yes.
So with that, we are once again out of time. Funny how that happens
every week.
I know.
like clockwork. So tell us, talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And for those that don't know already, what is Eat the State?
Eat the State is a small biweekly newspaper that we print and publish in Seattle, and it can be found in bookstores, cafes, coffee shops, bars, restaurants all around town. If you want to see us on the web, we're at www.eatthestate.org. That's eatthestate, all one word, .org. And our phone number is 903-9461, I believe.
The look of fear in your face as you were reciting those numbers was something to behold. But yes, you do have it memorized.
Did
it's
I have
wonderful.
It memorized? Good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it took me about a year also to get it right. And listeners
That's
who
true.
Were,
you always
were there
had it
then.
Written down and you'd be shuffling for papers.
And there were weeks when I got it wrong or I froze halfway through. And so you're doing yeah. very well,
do
actually.
Give us a call if you want to volunteer or if you have any yeah. anything you want to say about anything we've talked about.
Or story tips, anything like
yes,
that.
Yes, and we do like to get letters from people at ETS is our email address, ETS@SCN.org.